صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Doing a song from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The communique has been issued by G7 leaders. Their aim, Russia and China. They took aim at Beijing on issues like the South China Sea, human rights, and alleged interference in their democracies. Well, China has sat back and said, in fact, it is the G7 that is hindering world peace. So who's at fault here? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the G7's controversial communique, which said decisions taken by the G7 are aimed at containing Moscow and Beijing. That's something Russia actually said, using Ukraine as a tool to inflict a strategic defeat on Russia, amongst other issues. First, let me introduce our guest. George Zamioli, Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute, joins us from London. We also have Isha Krishnaswamy, who's a podcaster and journalist, joining us from St. Petersburg.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'll start with you, George Zamioli. Let's look at what the Russian foreign minister has said about this G7 communique. Decisions taken by the group are aimed at the double containment of Russia and China. What does he mean exactly by a double containment?
Well, it's that this very narrow grouping of countries, they are all members of NATO, with the exception of Japan, and Japan is a very close military ally of the United States, obviously. So this very narrow group of countries arrogates to itself the right to rule over the world, to create what it calls the rules-based international order. And who does this group regard as the chief adversaries of this imposed world order? Well, Russia and China. And they, it is quite clear from the very lengthy communique that they issued that they are targeting Russia, obviously, most strongly, but China also. And the communique speaks extensively about China, and it shows that this very small group of countries regards Russia and China as its chief adversaries.
All right, Isha, let's take a look at a couple, things that we've drawn out of the communique, which may indicate what Russia meant by this double containment, and I'm wondering what you think. Tightening sanctions against Moscow and then paring back exposure to China, also urging China to press Russia to halt its military aggression and immediately withdraw its forces from Ukraine. I take back the first part of what I said. Is the double containment meaning that Russia should be pressured by China to halt its military aggression? Is that the double containment just in that aspect?
I don't think so. I think the double containment refers to the West's wishes to limit the ability for either Russia or China to have foreign relations with other countries in the way, in the manner that they see fit. Because as we've seen from like the West's own admission, the G7's own admission, that they see this as a threat to the existing world order that they created in 1944 with the Bretton Woods Conference, the World Bank, the UN, the IMF. So I think that is what they're referring to. But within this, they see Russia as a threat for various reasons. The first one is because Russia does not really roll over. For example, in 2008, when there was the crisis in Ossetia, they sent their troops. And now, and again in 2013 in for Syria and here in Ukraine. So it Russia really imposes, prevents the G7 countries from exerting their desires on other countries. China, with the Belt and Road Initiative and their economic relations in Africa and Latin America, where they're building much needed infrastructure, is again a threat to the existing way the West does business, which is mostly use Africa and Latin America as a raw materials resource from which they suck resources and purposely impoverish the population. So that is what I think Lavrov is referring to as double containment.
Okay. Let's take a look at why Russia is offended, to say the least. Of course, they get offended every day by the U.S. and the G7 as a whole. But George Samueli, taking a look at what Lavrov has said, first of all, it's one thing for the G7, I guess, to use Ukraine as a tool to inflict, I guess, a strategic defeat on Russia. That's one thing. But Lavrov is saying that they openly not only want to defeat Russia on the battlefield, but to eliminate it as a geopolitical competitor. I mean, that sounds like eliminating Russia in a sense, doesn't it?
Oh, no question. When the Russian leaders, particularly President Putin, talk about this existential threat to Russia, they have in mind not just the military defeat of Russia in Ukraine, but the destruction of the Russian government and the destruction of the Russian Federation. I mean, it's the West is going all in. It's trying to essentially finish off the job that it started in 1991 with the dissolution of the Soviet Union, but the West somehow was quite happy with Yeltsin and allowed the Russian Federation to survive more or less intact. This time, the West is playing for keeps, and they want to see the Russian Federation gone. So the stakes are very high for Russia, and I think Lavrov's statement, and he's made many statements like that, indicate that, you know, ultimately Russia cannot afford to lose this, because if they lose this war, they lose their whole state.
When we hear, Isha, how, like our analyst there said, for Russia to be gone, the stance of the EU, or for others in the media perhaps saying for Russia to be gone, you know, when you take a look at that statement, it's beyond actually comprehension as to how Russia can be gone. I mean, you know, you can tell us how that is just not something that is based on reality.
It is not based on reality, because Russia has one of the fiercest militaries in the world, and they have one of the most advanced weapons, and the military and the weapon system works very well, so it is unlikely to happen. But that does not change the fact that the West definitely has plans for this. Earlier this year in January, inside the EU headquarters, they had a meeting about the Federation after Russia, where they were planning some kind of Yugoslavia-like Balkanization project. And in the 1990s, they kind of tried a little bit of that with the Chechen War. So that is definitely in the plans. And of course, it is very highly unlikely that they will realize this plan, but that does not change the threat to the Russian Federation by the West. And again, in Ukraine, we've had the defense minister say that he wants to target ethnic Russians. And for the past 8 years in the Donbas region, they have been doing that, targeting and endangering ethnic Russians. So there is both a danger for people who speak the Russian language and who identify ethnically as Russian, and also the state itself, if they do not fight back against the aggression posed by the West.
All right. George Samueli, instigating instability, human rights violations, interfering in democracies. Mm-hmm. So who do you think is making that statement, Russia and China against the G7 or G7 against Russia and China? Because if you use the, if you think of the G7, aren't they guilty, the respective countries, particularly the U.S. and the U.K., of committing the same violations as they have indicated against China in this case?
Well, of course, they've been doing this for decades. The United States has been interfering in elections throughout the world, and it's done worse things. I mean, it's organized assassinations, organized coups, instigated military insurgencies in countries all over the world. But because the Western powers assume that they are on the side of good, they're on the side of the angels, therefore it's obviously a good thing when there is a coup somewhere and the bad guys are removed and the United States was behind it. That's not interference, that's just God's will working on earth. So that's how the West sees it. Now, of course, when any other country seems to be interfering in other countries' affairs, and of course, they do it about 1/100th of the amount that the Western powers do it, then there is absolute indignation. And we remember the hysteria of Russiagate, which went on for 3 years, in which media personalities and politicians were tearing their hair out, screaming that this is the worst thing since 9/11, the Pearl Harbor, and the Kennedy assassination, Russian interference in the American election. So, yeah, I mean, every time the G7 says these things, I mean, you really have to just, take a cool drink.
Well, they're the leading countries, as they claim to be, of the world. Well, Esha, yeah. Another thing that they have voiced, and this is against China, is the militarization in the Asia-Pacific region. And we're not trying to rip apart this communique, but we're trying to understand where they're coming from. So when they talk about China's militarization and how that they think peace and stability should prevail, especially when it comes to the Taiwan Strait, isn't the U.S. the one, however, that's selling military equipment to countries like Taiwan? And correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't Japan for the first time to have unveiled a record budget, for its defense, 20% rise in military sales, of which obviously guess who provides the military equipment to Japan. So who's at fault here?
I would have to say definitely the U.S. First of all, we have to understand how Taiwan got created. It was Chiang Kai-shek's army that basically, when the People's Liberation Army chased them, they fled to Taiwan, and the PLA did not really have a navy, and the U.S. Navy blockaded the region, so that's kind of how Taiwan exists. And both Taiwan and China recognize the One China policy. They just defer on when and how the reunification is going to happen. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is, if we look at a map, it's in the South China Sea, and China has every right to defend its ports in the South China Sea. And I have no idea what the U.S. is doing all the way across the Pacific Ocean. And on top of it, the U.S. is also saber-rattling and trying to move the microchip industry out of Taiwan. And they are also militarizing Taiwan. And they were also involved in a color revolution involving the DPP party because the KMT became too soft for them. They wanted to do reunification and start negotiating detente with China. So I would say it's definitely U.S. is at fault. And China has been doing some sea drills with Russia in the Pacific, but that is a response to the U.S. Navy floats that are humongous, and they're in Samoa, they're in Marshall Islands. So I would definitely, just looking at a map and counting the distance between China and the South China Sea versus the U.S. shows you who's at fault here.
All right, and I'm going to have to also get your take on this, George Samioli, because this is pretty important. Because last time we checked, the U.S. is provoking China in many different ways. There's been plenty of, alarm bells going off that there's a coming war with China. Not to mention the fact that we're looking at how North Korea, in a sense, is reacting the way it is towards the joint military exercises that the U.S. has held time and again with South Korea and also with Japan. Perhaps they're not looking for a solution there because that will keep there at least a reason to give the U.S. Justification for its presence there. So this all leads to instability. Isn't that something that the G7 countries take a note of when they're issuing this in their communique?
Well, they should take a note of it, but of course they don't. I mean, because for them, China is just an aggressor state. You know, they're inexplicably doing these terrible things because they're a terrible country, a terrible regime. But of course, you're absolutely right. And what the United States is doing in Taiwan, and they say it explicitly, is pursuing what they call a porcupine strategy. In other words, they keep pouring arms into Taiwan and making it quite a strong, effective military power, so that should there arise a problem, but for instance, for China, they've already said the red line for them is if Taiwan declares independence. In other words, if Taiwan declares independence, they would have to resort to military action. They don't want to do it, but that's the red line. Well, if they pursue this, Americans help pursue this porcupine strategy, then that military action is going to become very, very difficult. And so what the Americans are doing in Taiwan is similar to what they were doing in Ukraine. I mean, they're building it up, until the point when Russia was just really was back against the wall and say, well, we can't allow this. We can't allow this armed aircraft carrier on our borders, absolutely rabidly hostile to us with its guns pointing at us. We need to take action. And that could well happen in Taiwan. I mean, the more it gets built up as a formidable military power, the more the Chinese are going to decide we have to do something now before it's too late.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, so we have about, I think, 17 minutes that we've torn apart the G7 in some sense. So let's look at one of the bright spots here, Aisha. And it was something that von der Leyen said, of which she said it's been described as a PG2. It's an initiative of $600 billion, which sounds like a great amount of money for what she has referred to as top-quality infrastructure, where Europe is proud to contribute half of it. I mean, this sounds great, right? But I'm wondering where the $300 billion is going to come from, while at the same time you have Europeans that are suffering so much from a cost of living crisis that they're out on the streets at least on a weekly basis. That kind of goes against their own economies, how people are suffering there. Why wouldn't she want to invest that kind of money in the countries of the EU?
Because we've already determined the EU is a currency union that is based on austerity, and it is a way to enact austerity, privatization, and all the things that purposely impoverish the people. Today, I just read a report that at least 30% of France is now food insecure. And this is the first time in a long time where this has happened. And so, of course, the entire purpose of the EU is to take away monetary sovereignty from the countries and their ability to develop programs for their own citizens and to force them into the Eurozone where they're forced into austerity, like what happened with Greece and what is soon to happen with Italy and Spain. So, it just goes counter to the design of the EU to actually use it to improve the lives of their own citizens. And as for the infrastructure project, I'm very skeptical of what kind of infrastructure they plan on using and what their plans are, because it seems like they haven't been able to do the infrastructure like China or Iran. It just remains to be seen if there are modern and competitive in the 21st century.
Okay, let's move on to the whole issue that they have stressed on, and that is no Chinese decoupling, George Samueli. Based on the communique, it said to coordinate our approach to economic resilience and economic security that is based on diversifying, deepening partnerships, and de-risking, not decoupling. So if they don't want to decouple from China, then why are they pushing to decouple from China?
Yes, that's exactly right. This is the line that they've been taking. They borrowed it from what they've been saying on Russia. So, well, we've got to eliminate our dependence on Russia. Now, they still keep buying stuff from Russia. They keep, they still buy oil, they still buy gas, they still buy food, everything else from Russia, precious metals, diamonds, gold, everything. They're still buying it. But they say, well, we are going to cut back on it. We're going to slowly but surely we're going to get less and less and less and less. So that's what they're now trying to do on China as well. Well, we're going to cut back on everything that all our dependence on China. And we say, look, it's perfectly reasonable that powers should eliminate their economic dependence on anyone. You should be self-sufficient to the best of your abilities. But that's not really what's going on here, because, of course, when you look at the EU, the EU is becoming a wholly owned subsidiary of the United States. So you may be decoupling from China, but you are not decoupling from the United States. So you're basically, Europe will become wholly dependent on energy imports from the United States, the liquefied natural gas. And, their economies are going to be shipped from your EU, where it's much too expensive, to the United States. And that will be that. That will be that as far as Europe being any kind of an economic power. So, all the talk about, decoupling from China, yeah. But you're in a much worse position than you were before. You are now wholly dependent on the United States.
Indeed. So my final question goes to you, Isha. We have also the G7 that has issued a very strong condemnation on China when it comes to economic threat posed by China. I'm not too sure how that really pans out in their thoughts. But they said that they need to untangle sensitive supply chains from Chinese influence. Now, there's two points here that I can bring up as examples. When it says that China should be out of the equation when it comes to supply chains, well, wasn't it the U.S. the one that blew up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline that led to a supply chain being disrupted there? And also when it comes to an economic threat, isn't the U.S. at risk of a default in their country of over $31 trillion, which could lead to a worldwide economic recession, or at a minimum for there to be a negative economic impact on the world financially?
The answer is yes to both. So with the supply chain, it is in the 90s, it was Bill Clinton who decided to deindustrialize the U.S., and many companies chose China because back then China had a policy that was easy to create manufacturing there. And so it is kind of the West's own doing that China is involved in the supply chain of so many different industries, but China also has about 1.4 billion people, so it is very hard for anybody in the world to decouple from China. As for the supply chain, yes, the U.S. blew up the Nord Stream, and on top of that, they're the ones who are enforcing sanctions upon Syria, Iran, North Korea, Russia, that really have the deleterious effect on the supply chain. For example, I was speaking to a man who worked at the shipyard here in St. Petersburg, and he was telling me how it is hard for them to build ships because certain parts come from Norway and other parts come from Japan, and they just can't get it. So a lot of them have been, shipping industry has been really hurt. So the West has been doing that. And as for economic coercion, the West has had hundreds of years to build infrastructure in Africa, in Latin America, and in Asia, and they just haven't done it. For example, the UK has had at least 100 years, but China has been able to build the high-speed trains. So it is basically the West crying that China is being able to compete in the marketplace they created.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time, Isha. Krishna Aswami, their podcaster and journalist from St. Petersburg. Thank you. Joyce Samiali, a pleasure. Senior Research Fellow, Global Policy Institute, London Metropolitan University from Budapest. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitale and the team, it's goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the verses of chapter Nur, the 24th chapter of the Holy Quran, and different commentary points of these verses. So stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
سورة أنزلناها وفرضناها وأنزلنا فيها آيات بينات وأنزلنا فيها آيات بينات لعلكم تذكرون
This is a surah which we have sent down and made that within it obligatory and revealed therein verses of clear evidence that you might remember.
Dear listeners, in the previous episode, we started discussing the very first verse of this chapter, chapter Nur, which is the 24th chapter of the Holy Quran and includes 64 verses. And the reason why it has been named a Nur or light, is the 35th verse, in which Allah has been introduced as Nur al-Samawati wal-Ard, the light of the heavens and the earth. So, this verse starts saying, Suratun anzallaha wa faradnaha. This is a surah which we have sent down, which we have enjoined. This part emphasizes this meaning, considering that the meaning of the word farada is assertion. Using the holy phrase ayatim bayyinat, clear signs, may point to some facts about monotheism, origin, resurrection, and prophecy, which are presented in it. This phrase is for the clause faradnaha wa anzalna. فيها آيات بينات. So this is a clause to فرضناها, we enjoined it, which points to the ordinances and commandments which are stated in this verse. In other words, one refers to beliefs and the other one refers to religious ordinances. There is also another possibility. The other possibility is that the purpose of آيَاتٍ بَيِّنَاتٍ, clear signs, is some reasons that are mentioned for the obligatory commandments that are presented in this surah. And the sentence لَعَلَّكُمْ تَذَكَّرُونَ, so that you might remember, again, illustrates this fact in mind, that all beliefs and doctrines and all practical programs of Islam are rooted in the very innate disposition of humans. Thus, their explanation is a kind of admonition and remembrance.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qum.
So the verse says, Suratun anzalnaha wa faradnaha. This is a surah we have sent down, we have enjoined. Wa anzalna fiha ayatin bayyinat. We have sent down clear signs in it. The reason is, la'allakum tadhakkarun, so that you might remember. So this illustrates that these beliefs, doctrines, and thoughts, they are rooted in the innate nature and disposition of all human beings. Now, in this world, all you have to do is to remember all those things that you may have forgotten. This thought, this nature, this a disposition, this being inclined towards the Almighty Allah, is in the nature of each and every one of you. All you have to do is to remember. لَعَلَّكُمْ تَذَكَّرُونَ, so that you might remember. We have sent down the clear signs in the Holy Quran, so that you remember. And in this holy verse, there are three signs that indicate the magnificence of Surah An-Nur. The first sign is the word surah that is in the beginning. And this is the sign of greatness. Suratun anzalnaha. This is a surah that we have sent down. This shows greatness. And then the Arabic narration of the word surah is for greatness. And the third point is the Quranic word anzalna, we have sent down, has been mentioned twice in due verse. This means that this very surah is pretty much important for remembering the thoughts, the ideologies that are connected to monotheism. And this is so important. Suratun anzalnaha wa faradnaha. This is a surah we have sent down and we have enjoined. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The Islamic Jihad resistance movement has organized a celebration event in Damascus countryside, marking its victory against Israel in the recent battle in the Gaza Strip. In a televised speech, Secretary General of the movement, Ziad Nakhale, announced the victory against the Israeli regime, expressing pride in the people of Gaza, who he said manufactured their own weapons with the help of member countries of the resistance front.
We succeeded in the battle and we preserved Palestinians' unity. We proved to the enemy our continuous readiness to engage in battle after another in defense of our people. Any assassination operation will be met with a strong, clear and painful response in which Tel Aviv or other Israeli cities will be in the range of our rockets.
The event was attended by representatives of Syria-based Palestinian factions. Speakers said Palestinians and resistance groups showed unprecedented unity through the joint operations room while retaliating against Israel. They rejected any concessions with Israel and refused to acknowledge any political settlement with the enemy.
We underline the importance of national unity and armed resistance, which is the only option we have. We reject concessions, Oslo Accords, or any security coordination or recognition of Israel. We call for boycotting Israel politically and economically and punishing the enemy for the crimes against Palestinians.
Videos were played on a large screen showing the retaliatory battle codenamed Revenge of the Free, including images of the Islamic Jihad leaders who were assassinated or lost their lives while confronting Israeli attacks. Resistance movements like the Islamic Jihad believe that resistance is not an option, but in fact a national duty which is based on the legitimate right of Palestinians to fight against the Israeli regime. And for long, it has been the only successful deterrent against Israeli aggressions in occupied Palestine. Hamad Ali, Damascus Countryside.
Just a couple of weeks ago, there were hundreds of refugees, mainly from African and Middle Eastern countries, sleeping on the streets outside the main asylum application centre in Brussels. Authorities have since cleared the area. The refugees have fled to neighbouring countries or have been crammed into emergency accommodation. A few remain in the area, but say their situation would be different if they came from Ukraine.
Only because we are Afghan, because we come from Syria, because we don't have the same color, because we don't have same culture, but it will be not the reason. Of course, a lot of people, we have the same mind. I can work, I can do everything.
When you come here from Ukraine, you get everything. Accommodation, food, work, everything. If you are from somewhere else, as a refugee, you do not get anything.
If you look, I cut also myself, because we don't feel good in camp.
Sometimes you want to die?
Yes, I want to die. You look at my hands, I cut it my hands too much with blades. I do it too much. Because what is it, life, eat and going to sleep?
A debate in the European Parliament has heard that EU nations are erecting borders on land and strengthening aggressive coast guard services at sea. The bloc pays billions of euro to outside countries to stop refugees from attempting to travel here, unless they are from Ukraine.
The EU slogan is, break the business model of smugglers. But what we do is feeding them. By blocking all pathways to protection.
There is a heavy far-right anti-refugee presence in the Parliament.
Europe needs a policy based on strong border control.
But many legislators are calling for a more civilized approach.
We already fund third countries like Libya, actually militias over there, to build camps, to host people there. And we see murder, we see rape, and we do not see a humane solution.
Key EU figures are currently in Hiroshima, Japan, for a G7 meeting. 350,000 people were living there when their closest ally, the United States, dropped its catastrophic atomic bomb in 1945. More support for Ukraine is high on the agenda. Critics say the last thing on their minds is providing refuge to those fleeing countries they helped destabilize in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
For the first time since massive regular protests began in January, the French government has held discussions with union leaders regarding a 2-year hike to the retirement age. A notable problem with that long delay is that the age hike has already been forced into law via a decree by President Emmanuel Macron. Public opinion is overwhelmingly against the change, but the government is standing firm, even though anger is rising to threatening levels nationwide. The First Lady's nephew was recently beaten by protesters over the age hike. Over 60% of the country wants the Prime Minister fired, and neither Macron nor his ministers can appear in public without protesters noisily banging casserole pans.
There's enormous anger right now. Macron has destroyed our social services, given huge tax gifts to the rich, persecuted injustices while allowing the far right to demonstrate without barely any police presence. And this is not even a complete list. People just want to live normally. But the Macron era is one of sadness and poverty.
Unions say the country will not get back to normal unless the age hike is revoked. But France has seen massive anti-government unrest regularly for well over a decade, and usually over far-right austerity measures. France and the European Union continue to be hounded by accusations that they are anti-democratic, and the latest of many French presidential decrees has only further increased dissatisfaction and dissent.
There is growing realization that our major national policies are decided in Brussels, and that our president is a mere puppet. We're also subservient to Washington. Simply look at what we're doing in Ukraine for more proof. So there's no hope that we'll have democracy during the last 4 years of Macron's term. But if we don't get it in 2027, things will explode.
Union leaders left the closed-door meeting calling it not useful and a one-way monologue.
The pension age hike has overshadowed other crises, such as record inflation, the arming of the unrest in Ukraine, and stagnant wages. But all of those remain unresolved flashpoints as well. Barring a surprise reversal from the government, unions are planning a 14th day of nationwide strikes next month. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Hundreds of Orthodox Jews protested outside the UK Parliament building on Tuesday over fears the establishment will begin regulating traditional Jewish faith schools known as yeshivot. Protest leaders made clear they considered any legislation targeting unregulated Jewish religious institutions as anti-Semitic, and they may be forced to flee Britain to protect their religious freedoms from unwelcome reforms.
Today, we face a concerning challenge as politicians attempt to push through a proposed register for children educated outside of school. This is no ordinary bill, but one that seeks to sneak in new laws through the back door under the guise of a private member's bill. This register proposal targets our strictly Orthodox Jewish community, intending to undermine our way of life more than any other group. It reeks of state-sponsored anti-Semitism.
What concerns these religious Jewish parents is regulated British education mandates lessons on lifestyles which contradict Jewish religious beliefs, including relationship and sex education, or RSE, LGBT propaganda, and other anti-religious ideologies, including atheism.
Well, we're not talking about murdering anybody. We're just talking about what we don't want our children to be taught. And we're just following what it says in our religion. And it's absolutely disgraceful that you're not allowed to do that in this country. And that's anti-Semitic.
These protests come after years of public anger expressed by parents, particularly British Muslims, over RSE lessons already being implemented in state schools. Opt-out options are not available, and accusations of indoctrination or anti-religious propaganda being fed to young children has been rife. In January 2023, a petition went viral, gaining over 200,000 signatures, demanding the government remove LGBT teaching from the controversial curriculum. The government responded, saying,
"The statutory guidance states that all pupils should receive teaching on LGBT content during their school years. Secondary schools should include LGBT content in their teaching. Primary schools are strongly encouraged and enabled when teaching about different types of family to include families with same-sex parents."
The ruling Conservative government has routinely attacked left-wing opposition over their support for the Palestinian cause and their criticism of Britain's relationship with the Israeli regime. However, and quite ironically, it's now number 10 that finds itself on the receiving end of not only accusations of anti-Semitism, but also Islamophobia and for being anti-religion in general, over an education system which is perceived to be discriminating against religious minority rights. Robert Carter, London.
The Japanese city of Hiroshima is set to host a G7 summit this week, where leaders of the U.S., Britain, France, Germany, Canada, Italy, and Japan will address pressing global issues. The meeting is also a source of controversy in other countries around the world, including South Korea, where activists at a Seoul forum slammed the event as diplomatic whitewashing.
This summit is a tool to conceal the terrible truth that countless Asian and Pacific people had to bleed due to 50 years of Japanese imperialism beginning in the late 19th century. It's a blindfold to cover Japan's hypocritical steps towards a nuclear-free world, peace, and rearmament, while dumping nuclear-contaminated water and scrapping its peace constitution.
South Korea's relations with Japan have always been controversial, but especially now as President Yoon Suk-yeol has sought to improve ties against the wishes of many South Koreans, who demand an apology for what they call Japan's colonial abuses. As world leaders flock to Hiroshima, South Koreans are reminded of a history the U.S. and Japan might rather forget. When the U.S. dropped the atomic bombs on Japan, in addition to more than 200,000 Japanese, estimates suggest some 40,000 Koreans were killed. Many of them were forced laborers. Some South Koreans say President Yoon is moving the country too close to the United States and a military alliance with Japan, which is seen as increasing regional tension. Japanese leader Fumio Kishida invited Yoon to the G7.
The South Korean government's participation is mainly to strengthen military cooperation between South Korea, the U.S., and Japan, and further strengthen military cooperation with NATO, which is mainly led by the United States. If South Korea's participation in the G7 was to reinforce the military alliance as a benefit, that can never be a good thing for the peace of the Korean Peninsula, as well as world peace.
While the summit plans to address the Russia-Ukraine war and economic issues, activists also argue the rich G7 nations need to do more to solve the humanitarian crisis now unfolding in East Africa. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A new report by the Institute of Watson Brown on their Costs of War project, which evaluates the results of the post-9/11 wars on affected countries, says the post-9/11 wars have caused more than 4.5 million people to lose their life in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and Pakistan. This study says that some of these people were killed in the war, but a larger number died indirectly due to the destructive effects of the war, which reaches 3.7 million people.
These mentioned casualties have different reasons. One is that the treatment centers have been destroyed due to war and medical aid seekers could not access treatment. Also, the widespread of diseases due to lack of health centers is countable. We can even refer to using bombs and weapons used in war that had environmental consequences that affected people. Overall destruction of infrastructures and long-term effects of the war is the main reason for casualties.
According to the report, tens of millions of people living in the war zones have also been displaced. The U.S. post-9/11 wars have forcibly displaced at least 38 million people in and from Afghanistan and the other mentioned countries.
Taking responsibility has three steps. First is to acknowledge they are the cause of this destruction and misery, which they don't. Second is ethical acceptance of the results of what they have done. And finally, there should be a higher power to compel them to take responsibility for what they have done. Some might say the UN is a higher power. Still, the UN is created by some countries which have the right or the veto right, and it shows flexibility towards these countries. There is simply no base on which these countries take responsibility.
The results of the war imposed by the U.S. on Afghanistan are the shocking numbers of 30% rise in food insecurity, 41% increase in children malnutrition and rising poverty, 1.5 million people left with disabilities and 2 million widows. Poverty, unemployment and poor medical conditions are considered only some of the results of 20 years of U.S. military presence in Afghanistan. Despite the fact that the war is over, people are still facing challenges due to the effects of that war. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
Industrial production in the EU's top economy, Germany, has suffered an unexpected decline. It's bad news for the entire bloc. However, a forecast published on Monday suggests the EU's economy is set to grow modestly. But downside risks are also growing.
Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine continues to cast a long shadow of uncertainty over the economy.
Grants to help struggling EU firms will soon be withdrawn, Eurozone finance ministers announced on Monday.
Companies that are receiving support will have to look at how they can support their own long-term viability.
A growing number of people are reaching the conclusion that the West could have prevented the war in Ukraine through constructive dialogue with Russia. The cost of living crisis resulting from the conflict is taking its toll.
It's time to be talking about peace, not about weapons or providing more financial aid
to the war.
If the parties could come together and agree a peace, that would be wonderful. But, you know, I'm not sure that's happening, right?
Apparently, financial markets are looking on nervously because so many things have been impacted by the war.
Due to the fact also of the uncertainties in China and lower exports and imports from China, and also due to the expectations of the economy in the United States.
A conference in Brussels on Monday heard that cracks are showing in the EU with respect to the war in Ukraine.
The Europeans have been united, but they need to be much more united.
Trade union members across the EU point out that wages are not keeping up with inflation as the bloc continues to spend billions of euro on arming Ukraine. Therefore, they suggest the onus is now on Western leaders to bring about de-escalation as a matter of urgency. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A great open-hearted and free-thinking Iranian poet, as described by Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi in a message read to the audience by the Minister of Culture on the occasion of Persian Language Day. Credited for reviving the Persian language through his literary masterpiece Shahnameh or the Book of Kings, Hakim Abulqasem Ferdowsi is honored every year on the occasion. Persian or Farsi, as referred to by native speakers, is a branch of Indo-European languages. It is primarily spoken in Iran, Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan, but widely understood in Central Asia. It is considered a relatively simple language to learn grammatically. It is written from right to left using a modified version of the Arabic alphabet. The Saadi Foundation in Tehran has made it its mission to promote the Persian language, Farsi. And Persian Language Day is the best opportunity for that.
Farsi is the key to a treasure chest full of gold coins. Our literature and Persian poems are the treasure inside that chest. I recommend everyone to learn Farsi.
I fell in love with classic Persian literature through the Ferdowsi's Shahnameh. It took him over 3 decades to write the book at a time when Arabic was the main scientific and literary language of Iran.
Shahnameh, or the Book of Kings, recounts Iran's mythical and historical past. The book is considered valuable cultural heritage for Iranians, while it serves as a great inspiration to learn Farsi for foreigners.
Foreigners say Persian is one of the most beautiful languages in the world. Persian Language Day is celebrated on May 15th to honor the world-renowned Persian poet Ferdowsi and his masterpiece Shahnameh, or the Book of Kings. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah.
May 13, 1984. Place Husseiniyah Jamaran, Tehran. Unfortunately, the interests of Islam and Islamic subjects undergone distortion were distorted, especially by Bani Abbas in the early days of Islam. One of them, who wanted to take out a letter of the Quran, an Arab drew his sword and said, "We answer with this sword." Muslim did not let the glorious Quran undergo any change. It is the same Quran that was revealed to the Messenger of Allah. Therefore, we have such a book containing personal, social, and political expediences, as well as statecraft.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Salamun alaikum, dear respected listeners. You are listening to IRB English Radio, and this is the Spring of the Truth. Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi alayhi, points to an important factor for maintaining the connection with Allah, which is performing the prayer. Prayer does not consist of just a series of words, a series of movements.